All right, it's time for our class to begin, and it's great to have everyone here. We are studying the minor prophets, and I hope that we are having an appreciation of the fact that the prophets are written in a historical setting. If you don't get that aspect of that, you'll never understand the writings of the prophets. Our ignorance of the prophets has led us to give a wrong definition as to what a prophet is. We generally describe a prophet as what? How do folks generally describe a prophet? Somebody who tells the future, right? That's exactly what a prophet, he prophesies all about the future. And of course, I grew up that, and that's sort of the definition. Hey Brian, how are you and Jenny doing? That's great, okay. Former members, okay, and when I went to Nashville, I want you to know, walked into the congregation where they were, this lady disrupted the class for 10 minutes, jumping up and down saying, Dan and Judy are here. I'm not going to return the favor, but it's good to see you folks, okay? All right. All right, sorry for the disruption, okay? And so, you know, a prophet is a spokesman for God. That's what it is. If you think about preachers, inspired preachers, that's what a prophet is. God needed a mouthpiece on this earth, and so he put a prophet here. And he gave them the message. That's why you've got somebody like Noah called a preacher of righteousness. Noah didn't have a Bible. Where'd he get his sermons? Well, God gave him the message that he was to preach. Abraham is the first man in the Bible specifically called a prophet. That's amazing, isn't it? You don't think about Abraham prophesying, you know, about the future, about anything. I mean, you know, yet he's called a prophet of God. And so now it is true that the prophets did foretell the future, but that was not their emphasis. They were God's spokesman. And so the minor prophets live after the time of the divided kingdom. How many times you have to hear something before you remember? Is it seven times that you need to hear something before you can hold on to it? I heard that somewhere in the past. Somebody says you've got to hear it seven times. This is the fifth time you've heard this. So you better be getting a hold of it right now. When Solomon died, the kingdom is divided into a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. Now, which kingdom is the best? The southern, thank you very much. And no roll tide as a result of that. I'll try it again. But southern kingdom was, how good was it? It was wretchedly terrible. How many kings were there in the southern kingdom? 19. How many of them were good kings? Four of them. There were four righteous good kings. So you got the four righteous kings in the southern kingdom. Northern kingdom, and this is the northern kingdom over here since you're on the north side of the building. How many kings did you have? 19. How many good ones did you have?
Zero.
Wretchedly, wretchedly terrible kings in the southern kingdom, and even worse in the northern kingdom. So bad that Elijah, the prophet in the northern kingdom, said, I'm the only righteous person left in the entire northern kingdom. Maybe, you know, at one time they had a... had an army of 800,000 troops in the northern kingdom. And it was so ungodly that Elijah said, I'm the only righteous man left on this earth. And he asked God to take me. Just go ahead and take me away. How many righteous people were there? You know the rest of that story? More than that. Oh, that's in Noah's and Noah in the flood. Very good. I asked the wrong question. You gave exactly the right answer. Now then, let me ask another question. In the northern kingdom, whenever the Lord said to Elijah, or when Elijah said, I'm the only righteous person, you remember how many had not bowed their knee to Baal? 7,000. So there's 7,000 people he was not aware of. But 7,000 out of a million plus people, there's not a whole lot of righteousness there. Now, the northern kingdom, and this is rather critical. What happened to the northern kingdom? Well, I don't expect you to remember this. If you remember this, you get an A+, and you don't have to bring the teacher an apple tomorrow to be in my favor. But the northern kingdom about 200 years after the divided kingdom, went to Assyria, went to Nineveh, went to Iraq. Now, I'd rather you, instead of saying Iraq, I'd rather you say Assyria, you know, because that's a biblical way of describing that land. By the way, that's why Jonah did not want to go preach to Nineveh. He wanted Nineveh to be destroyed. Jonah was from the northern kingdom, and he wanted Nineveh to be destroyed. He didn't want to go over there to preach. That's his motivation, but he wants God to bring judgment on them. But it's 200 years, and finally this kingdom goes into Assyrian captivity. And what happens is they were scattered all over the world. And so you may have heard of the 10 lost tribes. The Bible specifically names many of the areas where the 10 lost tribes went. So they really weren't lost. They lost their identity, The southern kingdom lasted 300 years. And since you guys had some godly folks over there, where did the southern kingdom go into captivity? Babylon. We know about the expression Babylonian captivity. How long were you there? 70 years. And then a decree went out into all the world, and from both kingdoms, people came back to Jerusalem. That's after the 70 years in Babylon. Now that's when the prophets lived. Most of the prophets lived prior to the Babylonian captivity. Some of them lived during the Babylonian captivity, and only three of them lived after the Babylonian captivity. And those are things that might really help. Now, here's where we were the last time we studied, what, 5-6 years ago? The book of Joel. Joel is where we were. We looked at that last time, and we talked about the fact that there are some differences in the matter of translations and everything. And so when you get to chapter 1, and the book of Joel, by the way, is on page 804, if you've got the Pew Bible, if that'll be of any help to you. There's a great, great plague that has come on this kingdom. Now, it's rather interesting that Joel does not have a date stamp on it. Generally, every one of the books of prophecy has a date stamp. You know, when we write a letter, we put a date stamp on it. If we do a legal document, we put a date stamp on it. And it's really, really helpful to read these books and to put the date stamp there. Because then you can get over in Kings and Chronicles and read what was happening. You've got the history that's happening, then you can see what the prophet was preaching at that time. But Joel is one of the kings, one of the books of prophecy, doesn't have a date stamp on it. Evidently, it was an early book of prophecy among the prophets simply because of the location where the Jews placed this book. And so because you've got in the minor prophets Hosea and Joel, you've got, it's very, very likely was was one of the early books. Not absolutely definite, but you don't really need to know. What's happened in the book of Joel? Well, the last time we studied, there was this plague of locusts that has come. Look in verse 4, and you've got a description of four different kinds of locusts. And depending on which translation you've got, it's difficult to look at a Hebrew word and try to decide exactly what bug we're talking about. Generally, the New King James, instead of describing four different kinds of locusts, describes the locusts perhaps in four different forms. The same locust, when they're the chewing locust, maybe in the lava state or something like that, and the swarming locust and the crawling locust, and it's immaterial. They knew exactly what kind of locust had been there. Here's the point: these locusts had come and destroyed everything. I mean, you look in verse 5, there are some folks that are in trouble in verse 5. Who's in trouble in verse 5? All right, the wine drinkers, the drunkards, the New King James says. Why? Well, where does alcohol come from? Where does wine come from? All right. What would happen to grapevines if a swarm of locusts came? Well, you know what would happen. And so they are in trouble. He says, you better wake up and you better start wailing. All of you drinkers of wine, because of the new wine has been cut off from your mouth. For he says a nation. And so now he describes this plague of locusts like a nation that has come up against the land, strong without teeth, and then the poetic nature of it. And that's why we're trying to look at the studies of the prophets, try to get a mindset. We won't be able to cover every one of them, but we're looking at books that will help us as we privately study some of the other things. And that is, he says, their teeth are the teeth of lions, fangs like a fierce lion, and they've ruined my fig tree, stripped it bare its bark. And so in verse 8 he says, lament like a virgin girded with sackcloth for the husband of her youth. What on earth is that all about? A virgin who is lamenting because of her husband. How long has she been married? Well, she's a virgin. We're talking wedding day here. Lament like a virgin clothed in sackcloth. What's sackcloth? Burlap bag? Is that, that you know? Anybody from Alabama, tell me what you used to call those burlap bags up in Alabama? Toe sacks. I have no idea why they were called toe sacks, you know. But I mean, that was just a name. I knew toe sacks a long time before I knew burlap bag. I got educated now. I talk like a Floridian. It's highly educated. She's clothed in sackcloth. And her husband is dead. Now he says, you, the nation of Israel, needs to be weeping just as much as that virgin. It's not a description of the fact, well, here's a virgin who's been impacted because of the locust. He's saying to God's people, trying to get them to turn back to God, lament like a virgin girded with sackcloth for the husband of her youth. And then the priest down at the temple, they're out of business. If the locusts have destroyed everything, where are you going to get the grain for the grain offering? Isn't that remarkable? Where are you going to find the drink offering, which was that which was poured out, a liquid which was poured out? Where are you going to find the sacrifice? They're not going to be there because this devastating plague has come and it has destroyed the land. Verse 10, pardon me, the field is wasted, the land mourns, for the grain is ruined, the new wine is drying up, the oil fails. Be ashamed, you farmers. He's covering it all, isn't he? From the drunkards to the priest, now to the farmers, because the wheat and the barley, the harvest of the field has perished. The vine is dried up. The fig tree is withered away. The pomegranate tree, the palm tree, the apple tree, all the trees of the field are withered. Surely joy is withered away from the sons of men. So he says, you priest, gird yourself and lament. Verse 13, you who minister at the altars, come lie all night in sackcloth, you who minister to my God, for the grain offering and the drink offering are withheld from the house of God. Consecrate a fast, call a solemn assembly, gather the elders and all the inhabitants of the land into the house of the Lord your God and cry out to the Lord. Only hope you've got is God. And you priests don't have any way to sacrifice or anything. You call that nation together. And you come to the house of God and you cry out in the house of God and perhaps God will hear. Alas for the day of the Lord is at hand. It comes as destruction from the Almighty. The food's cut off before our eyes. Joy and gladness from the house of our God have perished. The seed shrivels under the clods. Storehouses in shambles. Barns are broken down. Grains withered. The animals groan, there's nothing in the field for them to eat. They have no pasture, even the flocks of sheep suffer punishment. And then a prayer, O Lord, to you I cry out. Fire has devoured the open pasture, a flame has burned all the trees. The beasts of the fields cry out to you. The water brooks are dried up and the fire has devoured the open pastures. The only hope you have is God. Now, we need to have an appreciation that nationally, that is how God dealt with the Jews in the Old Testament. He dealt with them nationally. And he told them that if you go into the promised land and you arrive in the promised land and you're faithful to God, I will open up the windows from heaven and I will pour out such a great blessing on you that the whole world will marvel. He said, you'll be the head. You'll be above all nations, and every nation on earth will marvel at what you have. Well, what did they have? The promised land was described as a land that flowed. Remember what it flowed with? Milk and honey. Any picture you have ever seen of Palestine in the current situation, that's not the land they went into. It was a land that flowed with milk and honey. Josephus, the Jewish historian, says it almost this strongly. You just take a big old stick of dry wood and slap it down to the ground and it'll flourish and become a tree. He talks about the small amount of land that a man would have to provide enough food for his entire family. He talks about the Sea of Galilee and the abundance of the fish that were there. And that's the way that land was whenever they served God. But he says to them, if you're faithful, that's what I'll do. But if you're not faithful, instead of you being blessed above all nations, you will be cursed above all nations. And if you want to understand the reason, the reality for the anti-Semitic feeling that is worldwide, read Deuteronomy chapter 28. That is exactly what God said would happen to that nation. Moses is about to die. Joshua's ready to lead them into the promised land. And he said, if when you come into that land, you serve God and you will be blessed above every nation. But you come into that promised land and you're not faithful to God, you will be cursed above all nations on this earth. And he says, you will have unrest. And when it's evening, you'll say, oh, that it were morning. And when it's morning, you'd say, oh, that it were evening. And he said, every place that you go, you will be despised. You want to talk about the Holocaust? You want to talk about the anti-Semitic feeling there is around the world? You want to talk about the Muslims? You want to talk about all the unrest there is over there in Palestine? That's exactly what God said was going to happen. And so when Solomon dedicates the temple, Solomon says when there's a famine in the land, then the nation needs to come to this temple, to Solomon's temple, and pray to God that God will hear them. Hear him. Or God will hear them. And that they that the Lord will open up a window of blessing. Now, if you stop with chapter 1, you're depressed. Let me tell you, it's about to get worse. Chapter 2, if you think it's devastating so far, wait till you get to chapter 2. Blow the trumpet, he says. Sound an alarm in the holy mountain. Where's the holy mountain? That's not hard. This is in Jerusalem. Sound the alarm. Let all the inhabitants of the land mourn or tremble, for the day of the Lord is coming. It's at hand. A day of darkness and gloominess, a dark cloud and thick darkness like the morning cloud spread over the mountains. Not locust, but a people come, great and strong, the like of whom has never been, nor will there ever be such after them, even for many successive generations. You've seen the locust. You've not seen anything yet. Blow the trumpet. Trumpets could be used for a solemn assembly. Likely in this context, it means sound the alarm because there is, danger is coming. Turn on the hurricane signals. When the sirens go off in Florida, that's sort of the concept. Blow the trumpet because the day of the Lord is coming. Now, if you've ever had trouble understanding the book of Revelation, you need to start not in the book of Revelation, chapter 1. You need to start in Genesis 1. Because there is graphic, poetical language that is used by God in a time of utmost devastation. And it's not literal. And because we use it, I use it and you use it, and we commonly use figures of speech, we do not think literally. Our mind is programmed to think figuratively. And that's the problem we have. When folks get to the book of Revelation, they want to find in the book of Revelation literal fulfillment of things in the book of Revelation. There are four truths about the book of Revelation. Can you remember? We've mentioned them once or twice. It is what? It is revelation. Don't you ever say there's 65 books in the Bible that are understandable and one, nobody will ever be able to understand it. It is the revelation. It is a revelation to whom? To those seven churches in Asia. What you see, write it in a book and send it to the seven churches in Asia, and they are enumerated by name. And so there's a revelation given to seven churches in Asia. What of? Or how is it given? In signs. He sent and signified it. S-I-G-N is the word sign. That's the way you spell signify. You leave off the I-F-I and you've got the S-I-G-N. In the Greek, that's the exact way it is. They have taken the word symbol, the word sign, and created a new word. He sent and signified. Revelation to seven churches in Asia in signs of what? Things which must shortly come to pass. That's the book of Revelation. That's what chapter 1, verse 1 says. Verse 3 says, it's at hand. That's what the book of Revelation. But the reason we have trouble is because we don't understand Joel. We don't understand Isaiah. We don't understand this language used in the Old Testament. And figurative language always gets us in trouble because we don't understand it. See if I can illustrate. Man, David, the roof fell in on me yesterday. Where's your mind go? You don't go to a roof. It's one of the darkest days I've ever had in my life. You're not talking about, you don't think literally. And you and I, when we use figurative language, because we've always used figurative language, we understand it. Imagine translating figurative language into another language. Imagine you're talking to the Japanese, you're the translator. And here's President Obama, and he's talking to the Japanese premier, prime minister, whatever they have over there, to the head of the Japanese state. And Obama says, "You can believe what I said. I got this straight from the horse's mouth." You want to translate that? You translate that into Japanese. Horse's mouth. And yet if I said to you, I got this straight from the horse's mouth. You've got it. You understand it. Because figurative language, because we commonly use figurative language, we don't think literal. What's happened in our day is people have gone to the book of Revelation and they've talked so much about the apocalypse that, you know, that is there, that all they can see is the hydrogen bombs and everything. They won't take every bit of it literally. But the Jewish mind, and we're spending time on this in the book of Joel to try to help us get an understanding of these things. And so when he says that it was a day of darkness and a day of clouds and thick darkness, don't think literally, because it becomes a figure of speech. You want to translate this to the Japanese prime minister? Obama says, I talked to the head of the Chinese government, and what I said to him, he swallowed it hook, line, and sinker. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? Having lived in New Zealand nearly 10 years, I love some of the British expressions. I remember I'd not been in New Zealand long at all until the fellow, Mr. Haney, I remember his name, we rented the first place the church was going to meet at in Hamilton, New Zealand. And he says, you know, Dan, he says, it's a day out of the box. A day out of the box. You understand that? Is that British enough? It's a day out of the box. And fortunately, there's a New Zealand expression that is the most wonderful expression there is. Can mean no, it can mean yes, it can mean surprise. I had no idea what he meant when he said it's a day out of the box. But I wanted him to rent us that meeting place, and I wanted to be on his side, and if he thought it was a day out of the box, it's a day out of the box. The day out of the box. The New Zealanders have an expression. You got to be older British to understand this, but you know, he's 18 bob in the quid. What? You know, a bob is a shilling, which is a piece of money, and a quid is it takes 20 shillings to make a quid, or does it take 21 now? I think, anyway, you know what? Days, you don't have to worry about him. He's 75 cents on the dollar. Is that graphic? Is that graphic to talk about somebody not being a full quid? You understand what I'm saying? He's just not the sharpest person on earth. He's 75 cents on the dollar. I think that is unbelievably beautiful. But you see, they understood that. I have no idea what that is. Absolutely have no idea what that was the first time I heard it. Rather interesting. My oldest grandson grew up in Africa and came back to the States, you know, from Africa, went to Harding. We put him on our family cell phone so he could talk to us. And when he first got back, he'd call me from school, you know, a couple of times a week. He said, Granddad, I got to ask you something. Somebody just said something. What does that mean? He sort of had an idea, but he wanted to be sure so he knew how to respond. Now then, there's a nation that is about ready to come. Go back to the book of Joel. There's a nation that's about ready to come, and it is unlike anything you have seen for successive generation. And listen to the poetic beauty of this language. Joel chapter 2, verse 3. A fire devours before them, and behind them a flame burns. The land is like the Garden of Eden before them, and behind them there's a desolate wilderness. Surely nothing shall escape them. There is this nation that is coming, and when they arrive in front of them, it's the Garden of Eden, a land that flows with Yah. It's poetic though, isn't it? It's like the Garden of Eden. Literally, you'd have all sorts of problems with it. See, There were no weeds in the Garden of Eden. So you start taking this literally, you're going to run back and meet yourself in several ways. But he says it's like the Garden of Eden. And when they pass through, it's burning behind them. Nothing shall escape them. And listen to this language. Their appearance is like the appearance of horses. Like swift steeds they run. With a noise like chariots over the mountaintops they leap. Can you sense the poetic nature of this? Here they are, and they look like horses. A nation that looks like horses? What's that mean? Literally, it only means it's a female army made up of nags. You know, I mean, I just, pardon me. You take that literal? But he says, look at, here they come. And when they hit the mountaintops, they don't even slow down going over the mountaintops. They fly, or they go over the mountaintops like the noise of a flaming fire that devours the stubble, like a strong people set in battle array. Before them the people writhe in pain, faces are drained of color. They run like mighty men, they climb the wall like men of war. Everyone marches in formation, and they do not break ranks. They do not push one another. Everyone marches in his own columns. Though they lunge between their weapons, they are not cut down. They run to and fro in the city. They run on the wall. They climb into the houses. They enter the windows like a thief. I remember my mom and dad bought a book. You remember how Bible salesmen used to come around and sell Bibles? And so they bought this Bible. And in it, somebody found a prophecy of automobiles. Man, I was excited. Looked in the back of this book. Here's the Bible prophesies automobiles. I'm just a kid. And so, man, I rushed to it, and here it is. It says, let's see. They run to and fro in the city, and they run on the walls. And that's automobiles. And what else could it be? Well, probably everything else other than automobiles. Isn't that amazing? But somebody wanting to sell Bibles, or somebody wanting to be sensational, finds a verse in the Bible that says they run to and fro in the cities, they run on the wall, and you can't read the rest of it unless you got the car smashing into the houses and knocking down the windows. Poetically, the earth shakes before them, the heavens tremble, the sun and the moon grow dark, and the stars diminish in brightness. The Lord gives His voice before His army, for His camp is very great. Hello? We're in a poetical aspect of this, and we've got people that look like horses. You won't take it literal? People that look like horses that leap over the mountains. Better than the Superman. You want to take it literal? Leap over the mountains. And there is the Garden of Eden in front of them and a flame of fire behind them. And they march and they never ever break rank. And they do not push one another. And they're not cut down. And when they get in the city, they're just running around, running to and fro in the city. And they climb into the houses and enter the windows like a thief. It's not literal. It's poetical language graphically describing the magnitude of the devastation that's about to come. And so whenever he says, the earth quakes before them, the heavens tremble, the sun and the moon grow dark, and the stars diminish in their brightness, that's not vastly different from me telling David, yesterday was really a dark day for me. It was a day of gloom and bitterness. You know, this is not an American expression, but the sun was darkened. It was a dark night. The moon did not give its light. Stars fell out of heaven. Tragically terrible thing. And then all of a sudden, there's a transition here. He says, he says there is this people that is coming. That's in verse 2. And in verse 11, this people is described as God's army. Did God ever use wicked people to accomplish His purpose? Are you aware that Nebuchadnezzar, who in 606, 605 BC came and destroyed Jerusalem, is described, even though he is an atheist, he is described as the servant of God. You folks in the southern kingdom, you better hear that. When Nebuchadnezzar comes and you have been so ungodly that he's going to send you in captivity, and had it not been for the grace of God, you'd have been scattered and you would have never returned. But this pagan is called the servant of God. Northern kingdom, Isaiah chapter 10, whenever Nineveh comes to destroy you, when the king of Nineveh comes. Well, let's look at Isaiah chapter 10. That's too important for us not to get that. Look at Isaiah chapter 10. He talks about that Assyrian, depending on the translation, it may have him singular. It may have the nation itself mentioned. Isaiah chapter 10. Northern kingdom. Isaiah's got a message for you. Before your kingdom is destroyed, woe to Assyria, the Assyrian, you may have the singular of the king, the rod of my anger and the staff in whose hand is my indignation. Here's Tiglath-Pileser and all of those other kings that have been coming against Jerusalem, or pardon me, against Samaria, against your capital city. And the Lord says, they're the rod in my hand, they're the staff in whose hand is my indignation. I will send him against an ungodly nation. Guess who that ungodly nation is? It's you guys. It's the northern kingdom. But he's coming as the rod of my indignation. I will give him charge to seize the spoil, to take the prey, to tread them down like the mire in the streets. Then he says, he doesn't even know what's going on. Yet he does not mean so, nor is in his heart to think so. It's just in his heart to destroy. He's a vile, evil man, and to cut off not a few nations. For he says, are not even my princes like kings? So here's this evil Assyrian king, and the Lord says, he's the rod in my hand. I'm going to use him just like I used pagan, idolatrous Nebuchadnezzar to take Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and the Jews later over into Babylon. He is my servant. And in Isaiah chapter 10, he says in reference to the Assyrian, he doesn't even know what's happening. God used nations to destroy the Jews. Righteousness exalts a nation. God will turn into hell every nation that forgets Him. Has America forgotten? Yeah. And it may be that God could take a nation that's far worse than America, morally, a pagan nation, and use that nation as the rod of His indignations. Go back to Joel chapter 2. He says, that is my army, verse 11. Joel chapter 2, verse 11. The Lord gives His voice before His army, for His camp is very great. Strong is the one who executes His word, for the day of the Lord is great and very terrible, and who can endure it? That's remarkable. It's remarkable in so many respects. The day of the Lord is great and very terrible, and who can endure it? You got a marginal reading? Anybody have Revelation chapter 6? as a marginal reading. I've got to make up a verse. Is it 18, 19, or 20? I think there are about 20 verses in that chapter. What? 17. This very verse is quoted in the book of Revelation. And it's in Revelation chapter 6. And in Revelation chapter 6, talking about a different time. This day of the Lord's already been fulfilled. It was at hand during Joel's day. But in the book of Revelation, there's another army of the Lord that is coming. And these very words are used to say, when that army comes, who will be able to stand? And you know who the answer is? Chapter 7, the 144,000 and those of the nations who have washed their robes white and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Same kind of language. But the reason we have so much trouble is we got to find Hitler in the book of Revelation. That was a former generation. There's a book on the book of Revelation. If you can find me a copy of it, I'll give you $100 for it. I'm serious. That took the American Civil War and found every battle of the American Civil War in the book of Revelation. Now, the rider on the white horse is victorious. You remember who in the Civil War rode the white horse? Robert E. Lee. Obviously, that book was written by a Southerner. That book, a commentary on the book of Revelation, because I want to find what's going to happen. And so here's Robert E. Lee, and I'm going to find Gettysburg. I'm going to find all these battles of the Civil War. Remarkable, isn't it? We've got to understand the Bible. Well, let me say this. We've got to stop here in just a minute, right? I've got two more minutes. How much time have I got? I got 2 minutes. 2 minutes. What I want to say is really, really important, what I was about to say. I really want you to know that it's really important what I was about to say. Every symbol in the book of Revelation that has significance cannot be interpreted subjectively where I go to the book of Revelation and make up my own mind what I want those things to be. We talked about, I believe it was in here, about the beetles with their long hair. Somebody found them in the book of Revelation. Or you can find it. You can find Russia, Moscow, you can find Hitler, and you can find Vietnam, and you can find Iran and Iraq, and you can find 9/11, and you can find it all subjectively. The only way to understand the book of Revelation is to let God explain what that figurative language means. God wrote a book in symbols. Where's he going to find the symbols? Is he going to make them up, heavenly symbols? No. The language that was in the Old Testament is the language used in the book of Revelation so that the readers of the book of Revelation would have all of that imagery that's there in the Old Testament. And while it may, in the Old Testament may have talked about other nations, the symbolism is exactly the same. That's it. Thank you very much. We'll take up here next week.